tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Tommy McNeil reporting. China says it is not facilitating oil shipments to North Korea, which would be a violation of United Nations Security Council sanctions. This is a day after U.S. President Donald Trump accused China of doing so. Despite China's insistence, the sanctions are being enforced. Doubts persist in the U.S., South Korea, and Japan that loopholes continue to exist. And China's repeated denials did not preclude Mr. Trump from tweeting Thursday. He was very disappointed that China is allowing oil to go into North Korea. A new strategy in Syria for the United States following the collapse of the Islamic State. U.S. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis says now's the time for an attempt to move toward normalcy.
You'll see more U.S. diplomats on the ground, for example. So we're going to be training people how you clear IEDs. You don't want amateurs doing this thing. You're trying to set up, whether it be chlorinated water that prevents cholera, for example, schools open, that sort of stuff.
The approximately 2,000 U.S. troops in Syria would stay and provide security for the diplomats and civilians, as well as help with training and aid in efforts to hunt down IS fighters, estimated at about 1,000. After reports that more than 50 people were arrested in the past 2 days for protesting in Iranian cities against the country's economic troubles, the White House has issued a statement condemning the arrest. The State Department said that Iran's leaders have turned a wealthy country with a rich history and culture into an economically depleted rogue state whose chief exports in violence, bloodshed, and chaos. The State Department said it urges all nations to publicly support the Iranian people and their demand for basic rights. This is VOA News. This week, the remaining members of the Presidential Advisory Council on HIV/AIDS, or PACHA, are said to have been fired by the Trump administration. Council members received a letter this week saying that their appointments to the panel were terminated effective immediately, according to a report by the Washington Post. PACHA was established in 1995 during the Clinton administration to advise the White House on HIV strategies and policies. Six of the members of the council, upset by White House actions on health policy, resigned in June. A bomb blast this week in a Russian supermarket is apparently the work of the Islamic State. The group claimed responsibility for the homemade bomb attack that injured at least 13 people. Russian investigators initially said they were treating the case as an act of attempted murder. However, on Thursday, Russian President Vladimir Putin said the explosion was an act of terrorism. He made that assertion at the Kremlin during an award ceremony for Russian servicemen who had served in Syria. Funeral service is being held in Egypt a day after a gunman opened fire outside a church south of Cairo and at a nearby Christian-owned store, killing nearly a dozen people, including a policeman.
The death toll climbing to 11 people. She had three girls, shouts one woman, as mourners gather to pay their respects. Authorities say the gunman first opened fire at a Christian-owned shop, killing two people, before moving on to a church in southern Cairo, where the deadly rampage continued. Islamic State has now claimed responsibility for Friday's attack, but so far hasn't provided any evidence for the claim. The shooter, who was wounded and arrested, has been identified, and authorities say he's carried out several attacks since last year. Among those dead, a police officer who witnesses say died while trying to close the church gate to stop the gunman from getting in. Islamic militants have claimed several attacks on Egypt's Christian minority in recent years, including two bombings in April and a 2016 blast at Cairo's largest Coptic cathedral that killed 28 people. Police are stepping up security measures around churches ahead of Coptic Christmas celebrations in January.
The U.S. Library of Congress says it will no longer collect every single tweet published on Twitter, as it has been doing for the past 12 years. The library said this week that it can no longer collect everything across the entire social media platform because of recent changes Twitter has made. That includes allowing longer tweets, photos, and videos. It said in a blog post this week that its first objective will be collecting and archiving tweets. And it was a document, or to document, the emergence of social online media for future generations. The library has said that it will collect and archive tweets in the future, but will do so on a more selective basis. I'm Tommy McNeil in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us tonight. I'm Douglas Impuga. Peter Clote is on vacation.
Media showed video of civilians outside the church firing on the attackers to try and stop their deadly rampage.
At least 10 people are killed in an Egyptian Coptic church in a Cairo suburb.
Water is a basic fundamental human right. Water is life. When we've got no water, people die, and people are dying. Our health department is in shambles. A lot of people are actually suffering from diseases that they don't even understand because of consuming this dirty water.
The South African Constitutional Court finds the country's parliament failed to hold President Jacob Zuma accountable for a scandal over using public funds.
Most migrants use Libya as a gateway to Europe. The United Nations estimates about 700,000 migrants are in Libya. Barry says he wanted to stay in Libya, but he soon realized life was not any better.
And a UN report says migration is on the rise, with an estimated 250 million people living in a country other than their country of birth. Those stories and more coming up right here on Nightline Africa. Large crowds celebrated in Liberia's capital Monrovia Friday as the country's National Election Commission declared George Weah president-elect following a December 26th runoff poll. The 51-year-old Weah, a former football player and former FIFA World Player of the Year, is a senator who entered politics after his 2002 retirement. He's set to take office in January. My colleague, James Bate, is in Monrovia. Hi, James. What's the mood over there right now?
Thank you very much again, Douglas. Look, I'm speaking to you right now from the headquarters of the Coalition for Democratic Change. That's the party of the president-elect George Weah, where Mr. Weah is about to deliver his acceptance speech. As you know, the Elections Commission gave the final results of the runoff elections on yesterday, Friday, where showing that Weah overwhelmingly defeated the vice president of Liberia. I think won around 14 out of the 15 counties of Liberia. So that is what's going on. Everybody, the whole nation is waiting to hear the president-elect deliver his acceptance speech.
It must be indeed a very jubilant mood, given that this is the first time there's democratic transfer of power in more than 70 years in Liberia.
Exactly so. If you talk about jubilation, it's an overstatement, an understatement, because we are told that the party or the youth of this party has declared a 21-day of celebration to celebrate the winning of the victory of their party. Everywhere you turn in the city, particularly on the main corridor going into the city, traffic is a problem because people continue to demonstrate and rejoice in the streets. So it's a carnival-like scene here in Monrovia as the supporters of the Coalition for Democratic Change continue to celebrate the victory of their chairman.
Weah's victory aside, indeed, it must be a very big task that awaits him as he assumes office of president. Maybe he will elaborate in his speech, but how do people feel about the task that lies ahead?
Let me say, first of all, that the vice president, the incumbent vice president, Joseph Boakai, delivered a beautiful concession speech yesterday, not only recognizing the victory of George Weah, but also asking his people, all of his supporters, to throw their support behind the president-elect. Because he said that overall, while there was this political campaign in the run-up, now everybody must be Liberian and then get behind the president-elect. You mentioned the challenges that are awaiting the new president. Yes, they are real. The challenges are real because this country economically has been really down. And so the challenge for the new president is to see what he can do to rebound the economy. the education system, the roads network, even here in the capital city, Monrovia, the road system here is very poor. And what about the countryside? The challenges are enormous, and I think he recognizes that. The other thing is to see what he can do to bring about reconciliation between all Liberians. So those are the challenges awaiting the new president. But he told me on the day of election during my interview that he will need the support of every Liberian. He's no longer the chairman of the CDC or the candidate of the CDC. He is the president-elect of Liberia.
My colleague, James Bate in Monrovia, Liberia. At least two attackers opened fire on a Coptic church in the Cairo suburb of Helwan Friday, just over a week before Orthodox Christmas celebrations in Egypt. Around 10 people, including one of the attackers, were killed. Egyptian police say that they prevented an even bigger tragedy by preventing a militant wearing a suicide belt from entering the church. Edward Iranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
Amateur video showed people scrambling for cover as a gun battle rages between Egyptian security forces and militants attacking the Marmina Coptic Church in the Cairo suburb of Helwan. One of the attackers was killed by police and another was apprehended. Egyptian Health Ministry spokesman Khalid Magahed told Arab media that victims of the attack were taken to several hospitals in the region of Helwan. He says that around 10 people were killed, including one of the attackers, and that patients were taken to a number of local hospitals where some were undergoing emergency surgery. Arab media showed video of civilians outside the church firing on the attackers to try and stop their deadly rampage. Several policemen and civilian guards were reportedly killed defending the church. The Egyptian Interior Ministry has stepped up security measures outside churches in the lead-up to Coptic Christmas celebrations on January 7th. Terrorists have carried out a number of deadly attacks against churches and mosques in Egypt during the past year. A suicide bomber killed at least 27 people inside Cairo's main Coptic cathedral last December, while a bomb blast killed around 24 people at a Coptic church in Tanta on Palm Sunday. A suicide bomber was also prevented from entering the main Coptic cathedral in Alexandria on Palm Sunday, resulting in a smaller number of casualties. The bloodiest attack on worshippers in recent Egyptian history took place last month when militants attacked a Sufi mosque in the northern Sinai town of Bir al-Abed. Nearly 300 people were killed in that attack. The Islamic State group claimed responsibility for the mosque attack. Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, however, accused regional countries, which he did not name, of supporting the terrorists. Coptic Patriarch Tawadros told Egyptian TV before the attack that the country is waging a bitter and bloody battle against terrorists, but that the people remain resilient. General Mohamed Zaki, a former deputy interior minister, told Egyptian TV outside parties were trying to destabilize the country. He says that it is clear that there is a criminal plot to target stability in Egypt and the future of the state and its institutions by sowing fear in the hearts of its people, especially during religious holidays. He adds that the government has also taken exceptional measures to prevent the evildoers from carrying out their plans. Arab media has reported that many Islamic militants have been attempting to flee Syria and Iraq to parts of North Africa, including Egypt, following the defeat of the Islamic State group in some areas. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
South Africa's Constitutional Court has found that the country's parliament failed to hold President Jacob Zuma accountable for a scandal over using public funds for a multi-million dollar upgrade to his private home. As Tuso Kumalo reports for VOA from Johannesburg, the judgment could pave the way to another impeachment proceeding against Zuma.
South Africa's Constitutional Court has found that the country's parliament failed to hold President Jacob Zuma accountable for a scandal over using public funds for a multi-million dollar upgrade to his private home. As Tuso Kumalo reports for VOA from Johannesburg, the judgment could pave the way for another impeachment proceeding against Zuma. The court judgment was supported by the majority of justices of the Constitutional Court. Justice Chris Jafta said, Parliament failed to hold President Zuma accountable as stated under Section 89 of the Constitution. According to that section, Parliament may remove the President from office for serious violations of the law, serious misconduct, or inability to perform the functions of his office. In a judgment handed down earlier this year, the court found that Zuma had violated the Constitution by not paying back the money used for his Nkandla home upgrades as directed by the public protector. Justice Jafta added that Parliament does not have rules to implement Section 89.
The failure by the National Assembly to make rules regulating removal of a president in terms of Section 89 sub 1 of the Constitution constitutes a violation of this section and is invalid.
Several opposition parties approached the court to impeach Zuma after he was found to have violated the Constitution in the scandal. Constitutional law expert Luando Caso says the court's decision is the first of three steps paving the way for another impeachment trial.
Practically, it comes down to a vote. Let's say the rules are put in place, Parliament reconvenes and they put rules in place for 89, probably going to have another voting process. And now we have all this jurisprudence to inform that voting process.
Godrich Gadi, Secretary General of the Economic Freedom Fighters Party, says the rules should be in place before President Zuma gives his next State of the Nation address in February.
We can't wait any other day longer. We need to be in Parliament in no less than 30 days before the State of the Nation address of 2018.
However, the judgment was marred by controversy after Chief Justice Mokgweng Mokgweng insisted that his opposing views to the judgment be read into record. He warned that by tolerating the matter, the court was interfering with another arm of state, the parliament. Zuma has survived 8 motions of no confidence in parliament, but with the ANC divisions now distinct following the party's elective conference a week ago, political experts warn he may not survive another impeachment effort. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
In Zimbabwe, some residents in the capital Harare want the mayor to step down because of chronic bad tap water. He had urged citizens to use caution as water in Zimbabwe's capital was not safe to drink. Sebastian Mohofa reports for VOA from Harare.
In Zimbabwe, some residents in the capital Harare want the mayor to step down because of chronic bad tap water. He had urged citizens to use caution as water in Zimbabwe's capital was not safe to drink. Sebastian Mhofu reports from Harare for VOA. Text. Residents directed their anger at Mayor Bernard Manyenyeni during a public meeting where they complained about muddy, colored and smelly drinking water. Some parts of the capital city have gone for weeks or months with dry taps despite above normal rain in Zimbabwe last season. Linda Masarira is one resident who attended the meeting, which lasted close to 2 hours.
Water is a basic fundamental human right. Water is life. When we've got no water, people die, and people are dying. Our health department is in shambles. A lot of people are actually suffering from diseases that they don't even understand because of consuming this dirty water. Everyone should get clean, safe, potable water coming out of their taps. From here, we're going to make an appointment with the local government minister. Since the mayor said his hands are tied, if we don't get any luck there, we go to the president's office. We'll go all the way until safe, clean water is coming out of our taps.
Most parts of Zimbabwe do not have access to clean water, forcing residents to rely on open sources thus exposing them to waterborne disease. A cholera outbreak in 2008-2009 claimed close to 5,000 lives, according to UN statistics. The situation could have been worse had international organizations such as USAID not chipped in providing water treatment chemicals, among other interventions, to ensure proper sanitation in Zimbabwe. Sharon Mumbula fears that the situation in Harare might escalate to 2008 and 2009 levels unless Mayor Manyenyeni steps down.
I'm wondering why he's even sitting there, why he was hired. Clearly he can't. He can't execute his duties, he can't execute his job, because some of the answers that he gave us, they're not even relevant to the problem. Because clearly he can't say, he doesn't know where the unclean water is coming from, but yet it's the whole of Harare that is affected. So it's time for him to go.
At the meeting Friday, the mayor said he would not step down, but would not seek re-election in 2018. After the meeting, Manyenyeni told VOA that he was hopeful Harare's water problems would end one day.
We think we are providing you with water that is good for you and your family to drink. We have seen experiences of water that does not look good. Water that looks greenish and brownish, water that froths or forms. Let's share the responsibility. While we assume and claim that our water is clean and good to drink, we ask you to exercise caution wherever you are and make your own personal decision about what you see, what you smell. Is it good enough for you to drink? If you are not satisfied while we're fixing the problem, please avoid drinking water which you consider suspect. The time frame relates to the time the availability of forex, which is not a council problem, it's a national problem.
Zimbabwe is facing a critical shortage of foreign currency, forcing businesses to source it on the black market, resulting in price increases on most commodities. The mayor ruled out getting foreign currency on the black market so that Harare can import water treatment chemicals. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
According to a UN report, migration is on the rise. There are now an estimated 258 million people living in a country other than their country of birth. This has increased by almost half since 2000, the report says. Earlier this month, 60 migrants returned from Libya to Sierra Leone with the help of the International Organization for Migration, or IOM. Migrants from Kuwait were also returned earlier this year. Nina De Vries has more on what their experience was like. She reports from Freetown, the Sierra Leonean capital.
Mariama Doe is one of hundreds of migrants who came back to Sierra Leone this year. She's relishing her freedom after having spent 10 months in Kuwait. At first, she thought she was going to work as a security guard. When she got there, she was sold as a housekeeper through an agency to several families.
I was not happy in Kuwait. Always I can cry. Every day I can cry when I remember home. And I remember my two kids. I can cry every day, every day.
She says she only got paid once the entire time she was there and was forced to work almost 24 hours a day. When she got sick, there was no sympathy.
I don't have choice. They will say, go and work. You are here for this work. You don't have to sit down. You don't have to rest. We'll buy you for this job. You have to work.
She managed to escape while the family was out one day. Through the help of a stranger on the streets of Kuwait, she was directed to the International Organization for Migration. After several months in a shelter, she was brought back to Sierra Leone with the IOM's assistance. It helped her reintegrate into society by providing financial compensation to set up a business. She now sells clothes and says it's enough to keep her going. Abuse of migrants is happening in many places. Most recently in Libya, there were allegations of migrants being sold in slave markets. About 60 migrants were brought back through the IOM and the Sierra Leone government in mid-December and another group in late November. Umaru Berry is one of the migrants who just returned from Libya. He left Sierra Leone because he was jobless and homeless.
And when my little money finish, I don't have place to stay. So sometimes I sleep in the beach. Sometimes I sleep in the ghettos with boys.
Most migrants use Libya as a gateway to Europe. The United Nations estimates about 700,000 migrants are in Libya. Barry says he wanted to stay in Libya, but he soon realized life was not any better. He also describes not always getting paid for work, and his wife, who he met in Libya, often had payments withheld. They eventually managed to get in touch with the IOM in Libya and started the process to be repatriated to Sierra Leone. Barry, his wife, and their son arrived in the early morning hours of December 14th on a chartered flight. It was bittersweet.
I don't have money, but I'm too okay for my life and my family.
The IOM will also compensate Barry, and he's hoping to start up a business. For now, he's staying with his brother. And although it's tough starting over yet again, he's grateful to be out of Libya and back in his country. Nina DeVries, VOA News, Freetown, Sierra Leone.
Meanwhile, the United Nations Refugee Agency has initiated an innovative program to promote and nurture talent among refugees and asylum seekers in Kenya. It's called the Artists for Refugees Initiative. It aims to empower artists from Kakuma and Dadaab refugee camps in northern Kenya, as well as those residing in Nairobi. From the Kenyan capital, Ruben Kiama reports.
That's Ugandan-born Marte Stevens, popularly known as Poison, performing recently in Nairobi. He acknowledges that he's gay. He says he was forced to leave his home country for Kenya following threats directed to him as a homosexual.
There's a law that was passed in Uganda against the anti-gay bill that was passed in Uganda, so I'm gay. So I decided to leave because they had passed it that if you're caught, maybe you leave or life imprisonment. So I saw that like as an harassment or unfair. I decided to flee to Kenya seeking for, I call it peace, shelter and whatever, and things, basic needs, because I couldn't get the services in Uganda since I was gay.
The East African nation passed legislation outlawing homosexuality in 2014, a move that received widespread condemnation from human rights activists and the donor community. Uganda, like most of Africa, is a deeply conservative society which terms homosexual acts as unnatural and illegal. Another refugee artist, Mahalet Ekube from Ethiopia, has lived in Kenya for many years. She says she fled her country as a young girl to escape political persecution.
Political instability. Mostly, but I was so young, I did not know about the politics as much. Also, communication sometimes can be so hard, learning English and Swahili at the same time. Cultural shock, the culture is different in Kenya than in my country.
As a refugee, the 23-year-old university student has finally found a voice in painting.
I developed an interest in visual arts when I was young, at the age of 7, then proceeded till my teenage years and now to my early 20s with my parent.
And Dadaab refugee camps in northern Kenya. Dadaab is home to hundreds of thousands of people, mostly Somalis, who fled across the border following the outbreak of civil war in 1991. Many have lived there ever since. The UNHCR official says the program has been a major success.
We started that 3 years ago. We didn't know where it would go. But every year we see better quality, we see more artists, and we see how important it is for them, how important it is for refugees that we recognize their artists. And that's why I would say that this program has been a success.
The artists hold exhibitions where they can sell their art to Kenyans and to expatriates. They use the proceeds to support their work and to help their families buy food and pay for school fees. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
This is the Voice of America, and you're listening to Nightline Africa. And still to come in the program, our Saturday music spot from our collection of music from across the continent. But first, a tribute to an African legend, Philip Bongo Lebutaya. Here is an anchor report by my colleague Cecily Hillary.
Tonight we profile a man who, through a simple, courageous declaration, helped a public in denial face the truth of the AIDS epidemic. He is Ugandan pop star and activist Philly Bongoli Lutaya. He was born in October of 1951 in Mengo, a suburb of Kampala, Uganda. His father Tito and his mother Justin were both teachers. Philly attended primary and secondary schools in Kampala, and he began playing guitar as a teenager. By 1969, he was playing rumba and Afro jazz in Kampala nightclubs. He was strongly influenced by Western artists, including Elvis Presley and the Beatles. In fact, in those early days of his musical career, he was known for his rendition of the Beatles' hit Let It Be, which was one of his favorites. At 19, Lutaya moved to Kinshasa, Congo, where he played in and was influenced by a vibrant music scene. 2 years later, he was back in Kampala, playing in various bands. But Uganda's growing political instability during and after the Idi Amin regime pushed Lutaya to join a growing number of musicians in the diaspora. For a few years, he lived in the multicultural city of Nairobi, Kenya. And then in 1984, he moved on to Sweden. There, he organized a new band called Miti Mito, which became the foundation of a second band, Savannah. In the end, Lutaya went solo. He released Born in Africa, both a single and an album, and these went mainstream back home in Uganda. And so we come to 1989. Lutaya was at the peak of his career. And back in Uganda, the AIDS epidemic was also at its peak. Today, Uganda is hailed as a success in the fight against HIV/AIDS in Africa. But 20 years ago, it was another story. Doctors and health professionals knew about the virus, but few among the general population understood what they called the Slim disease. In some areas, it had infected over 30% of the population, and sex was not a thing to be discussed publicly. What Lutaya's fans didn't realize was that he himself had contracted HIV/AIDS. At the risk of ruining his career, he decided to speak out. On April 13, 1989, he spoke at Makerere University in Kampala. AIDS, he told the students, was a disease that was spread through sex and blood contact. And he admitted publicly that he, too, was a sufferer. 5 months later, he released the song and album Alone, part of an attempt to reduce the stigma and increase awareness about AIDS. In the remaining months of his life, he became involved in a number of awareness programs, and he traveled with both the Swedish and Ugandan Red Cross societies. Lutaya returned to Uganda for the last time on December 2nd of 1989. He died late on the morning of December 15th at Nsambia Hospital in Kampala. He was 38 years old.
Out there somewhere, alone and frightened, all the darkness, the days are long. Life in hiding, now more making you contact. Now more loving arms going around my neck.
2 decades after his death, the Philly Lutaya Initiative Association continues its namesake's mission to educate the public about how to prevent HIV infection. Philly Bongole Lutaya, an African legend.
Today it's me. Tomorrow someone else. It's me and you.
times of joy, in times of sorrow, let's take a stand and fight on to the end. With open hearts, let's stand out and speak out to the world. We'll say some loud, say the children of the world. Let's be open, advise the young ones and new generation to protect and love. Hear them singing, playing, laughing. Let's give them everything in truth and love.
Yes, yes. And now it's time to for our Saturday music spot. After that tribute to Philip Bongo Taya. Yes, time to relax and enjoy great music from Africa. Mm-hmm.
Kali mundeke nange, kwenzi jukira mu chemfuti, endo sa tukuvana. na odada nebagen akanga etali musana o mama ulala yeah. Oh agaliba
enjole
oh agaliba
enjole
atitoba kona chongamba jango muziki tugusambe gambe toba kona chongamba jangwenu twichange
ayelelelele Muziki zuri sana
Nekanzime
Nengzi na mumu Kula mubwaji sera Ato muziki jambu sana Zinamu Zina Zinamu awo Zina Zinamu Zina Zinamu awo Zina Yelelele Sani Brown, Sani Brown, Sani Brown, Sani Brown,
Sit down,
you may have to be a son now. That kitchen.
Yes, yes, yes. Badilisha by Ugandan musician Jose Chameleon. That ends our Saturday Music Spot. Hope you enjoyed the music. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. From the rest of the Nightline Africa team, thanks very much for joining us. See you tomorrow Sunday. I'm Douglas Mpoga.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is assisting law enforcement in Senegal with a donation of critical, non-lethal law enforcement equipment and materiel to the country's national police. At a ceremony on December 20th at Senegal's National Police Academy, U.S. Ambassador to Senegal, Tulanabo Mushingi, said the U.S. counts on Senegal as a crucial partner in the region and the police as a vital bulwark to the multitude of threats and challenges facing both nations. Terrorism remains a scourge that we must continue to fight, and this donation of equipment, such as computers, projectors, night vision goggles, crime scene kits, and protective equipment, will provide additional support to bolster the National Police's mission, said Ambassador Mushingi. He noted that recently the embassy's Regional Security Office and the Department of State's Bureau of Counterterrorism and Countering Violent Extremism wrapped up a training series implemented by the Bureau of Diplomatic Security's Anti-Terrorism Assistance Program designed to better protect against and mitigate the impact of a terrorist attack on soft targets for the Senegalese law enforcement community and first responders, including interagency coordination of counterterrorism operations mechanism established by presidential decree last year, CICO. Altogether, approximately 110 personnel have benefited from these recent training events for a significant engagement between the U.S. and Senegal. The latest U.S. donation, worth nearly half a billion francs, CFA, is a significant contribution to the ongoing partnership. Paraphrasing Senegal's President Macky Sall from the Forum for Peace and Security, Ambassador Mushingi said the need for integrated solutions across the region was emphasized. Training and equipment are at the heart of this integrated solution, and we are happy to provide this protective and didactic gear to the government of Senegal to seek these integrated solutions. To this end, we are glad to bolster the police officers and especially all the first responders who we depend upon to act in the event of troubles or a deliberate attack, said Ambassador Mushingi. To our friends in the National Police and other Senegalese security services, thank you for your assistance. We hope this equipment will help you with your mission.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.